4 minutes and 23 seconds have passed. That's half the time that George Floyd had a knee on his neck.
My earliest experiences dealing with race occurred while I was in secondary school. I was privileged enough to make it into the top public school in my state. I remember my first day of fifth grade when we were introducing ourselves. I said both my parents were teachers. "Wow, your parents graduated high school?" the white kid next to me asked. I asked him something along the lines of, "Yeah, why?" And he responded, "Well, because you're black."
I was in the third grade when I started attending a private school that was predominantly white. My sister and I were one of the first people of color the school had ever seen. I had befriended a few of the popular girls in my class. One day I was late to the playground. I saw the group of girls playing together and I went over to play with them. When I asked them to jump into the game, they stared at me with a repulsive look. The ringleader said, "We don't want to play with you anymore because you're not like us and your hair is different than ours." It was hard to register what they meant at first, because why would anyone not want to play with someone else just because of their thick black curly hair that they were born with? I was so hurt because in my third grade mind, I had assumed they were my friends, and friends don't make other friends cry. It was one of the first times my innocence was stripped from me, and I realized that even my light, fair skin was still seen as black, and I was not the same as them. To this day, I still struggle with loving and feeling pretty with my natural curls.
Rather than my earliest experience with race, I'll share my most painful. Nothing hurts more than your child's first encounter with racism. I'll never forget the day my youngest son came home from third grade and told me David Walker called him an N-word. I always knew that day was coming. I wanted to let loose with my emotions and anger, but I knew that wasn't going to achieve anything. It might just confirm an expectation about how a black person would behave. I called David's house and his mother answered the phone. I told her who I was and said, "I'm going to assume you don't know what happened with David and Mark today. Otherwise, I'm sure you would have called to apologize." She knew, but her instinct turned immediately to protecting her son. "He didn't know what the word means. He didn't understand. He's not a racist. Please don't think of him that way." I interrupted her and said, "All that may be true, Miss Walker, but frankly, this moment is not about David's defense. It's about how my son is feeling and what I'm asking you to do about it. To have David apologize, to have him tell Mark he knows what he said was wrong, and that he didn't mean to deliver the sting and stigma of that word. David apologized, but it was hollow." The next day, my son went to school knowing that everyone, it seemed, heard him tagged with that word. The apology didn't erase the incident. I doubt he really understood that was the day he learned he could be singled out as other in the most hateful way. But I knew that he had arrived at that day and that it would surely happen again.
It was at high school where I had my earliest and most visceral memory of racism. It was senior year and I was vying for homecoming queen, along with all the other girls who were outgoing, engaged, and exuding school spirit. After a long buildup, the voting happened. I could barely sleep that night. When we arrived at school the next morning, the list was posted. There were 6 homecoming princesses and 6 princes in the homecoming court, and I wasn't one of them. I was disappointed and a little surprised based on the whisper talk. That night, I cried over it with my mom. The phone rang. I heard an odd, stilted conversation. My tears gave way to my curiosity. My mom said it was an anonymous caller saying that the homecoming ballot box had been rigged. Unsure of what to do, my mom went to the high school principal the following morning. She asked hard questions. He admitted with me in the room that it was not okay for a black princess to be seen with a white prince. And he had decided to make a substitute for me in the homecoming court. I asked why, but I guess I knew. This was the problem of being the only black family in my town. I don't remember the rest, but I do know my mom fixed it. But on homecoming night, it never felt right. I felt like an imposter. I didn't feel pretty or worthy. My date, Scott, was the football team star, loved by everyone. I even felt like I was disappointing him. I was already tired of being Black.
My first experience where I was acutely conscious of my race didn't happen until college. Growing up in a mixed race home, it never occurred to me to treat anyone different because of how they looked. Consequently, it never occurred to me that anyone might treat me different on account of being Black. It never occurred to me that no one was asking my white friends, "Where are you really from?" "Texas." "Is that the language of your people?" "No, it's an assignment for French class." "Why are you driving late?" "I'm on my way home from work, officer." Or, "Do you have any more of this in the back?" "No, ma'am, I can't check that. I don't work here." The first time I really internalized that someone might be treating me differently happened in college. I was walking a drunk friend home back to their dorm after a party. It was cold and late. So after I saw them, I started jogging home. About halfway back, I passed a group of guys on the other side of the street. As I passed them, one of them yelled, "What'd you steal, N-word?" Surprise, I stopped and looked around. No one could conceivably be talking to me that way. The one who yelled saw me and stopped and followed up with, "You heard me." The rest of the group burst out laughing. I ran home much faster.
I went to a predominantly white boarding school for high school. I was 14 years old, miles away from home, and for the first time, I was often the only person of color in many of my classes. This was the first time I truly knew what it meant to be a minority. There were so many things that I had to go through and experience alone. The shame I felt wearing a bonnet to bed, or the assumptions made about my scholarship status, fielding questions about the latest slang words, being in an institution where words like headmaster and housemaster were the norm, constant digs at my intelligence from students and teachers alike. The classic American novel, Huck Finn, was mandatory reading for all freshmen. I will never forget the first time we read passages out loud. The sting of the N-word rolling off the tongues of my white peers like it was nothing. The permission and insistence to read the text verbatim came from my white male teacher. There was no regard for how that would make me feel, no sense of awareness or empathy. An adult who was responsible for my mental, emotional, and physical safety harmed me in ways he'll never know and empowered white students in their feelings of superiority. Not to mention the burden placed on my shoulders to represent and speak for all Black people at the age of 14 and correct the narrative that was being told. I never actually said the N-word when he called upon me to read in class. I knew that defiance didn't sit well with my teacher, but I also knew it would make others think twice when the only Black person in the class refused to say the word. One of our most prominent Black donors visited the campus that year. I made it my mission to speak to him and illuminate my experience, as well as the experience of my Black peers. Because even though I was a minority, I wasn't alone, and I wasn't powerless. Huck Finn was removed from the curriculum and has not been taught since. The administration hoped to properly train instructors on how to teach sensitive content. 15 years later, I'm still waiting for that training to happen.
One of my earliest experiences dealing with race occurred during my sophomore year of college when Trump won the presidential election. In celebration of his election, two students from Babson College started to terrorize Black students at Wellesley College, many of whom were friends of mine. They yelled, "Make America Great Again," spit at them, called them racist and homophobic slurs while doing loops around their living space in a pickup truck. I often think about the students at Babson College and other schools who held the same beliefs as those two, but didn't feel empowered enough to drive out and frighten other students. Where are they now? What businesses are they running? What policies are they writing?
My parents self-admittedly protected me from an early age. They were Black and from the South, living in an all-white suburb on the West Coast. My father always told me that I can do or be anything that I wanted, while at the same time guiding me to navigate around the unwritten rules of how not to be an uppity Black person. In that regard, he assured me that I should expect to work twice as hard for half the credit. That's what he did, and he was the valedictorian of his 1954 high school class. For that honor, he got to enlist in the Air Force. Most colleges weren't accepting Blacks back then, and those that were required more money than he had. He is the second of 12 kids. My grandparents were former sharecroppers.
I didn't know that I would have to keep defending my right to be educated while Black throughout the rest of my career. That all of my accomplishments or talents would be judged in reference to the color of my skin. You speak so well for a Black kid. This college is too difficult for you. You won't get in. You only got into college because they needed to bump their diversity quota. Or are you here on an athletic scholarship? Why did I have to be scrutinized and criticized just because I had the audacity to be Black and pursue my passions?
My earliest experience dealing with race, in the US at least, was during my freshman year at college. Prior to this, most of my exposure to the United States came from film and music, mediums where African-American narratives are strongly represented, at least if you're looking in the right places. So when I left my home country for college in the United States, I knew enough to expect I'd be feeling at least a little bit of otherness, and that as a young Black immigrant, there would always be a silent urgency to being on my best behavior at all times, particularly around authority figures. That was all priced in, and so I wasn't sensitive about it. But in my first few weeks, what caught me totally unprepared was the nervous and slight fearful glances from my own classmates, most of whom were 18-year-old kids from suburbs across the country. At times, it felt like that gaze followed me everywhere, whether I was searching for a seat in a crowded lecture hall, entering my dorm building, or taking a nighttime walk on the streets of my liberal college town. On a campus where only 2% of the students are Black, many of them athletes, I definitely looked out of place. And predictably, this manifested itself in racial profiling that was sometimes a bit comical, like when a student somehow mistook me for an athlete, and sometimes very scary, like when a police officer slowed his car down by me in the middle of a run to question, what exactly was I running away from?
Early on in life, well before I was able to drive, I was trained on how to interact with the police during a traffic stop. Turn off your music. Roll down the window before the officer arrives. Keep both hands on the steering wheel. Ask questions before moving. My wallet's in my back pocket. May I reach for it? And my insurance information is in my glove compartment. May I reach for it? When I started driver's ed, I assumed this was a lesson that everyone had received. I was initially stunned that my classmates had never learned this lesson. Later, I was even more stunned in how many times I've had to use this lesson.
In college, I was an athlete. The school I attended up until my sophomore year was halfway across the country. My coach gave us a week to fly home to spend with our families before training camp started up. I flew back to NYC. After a couple of days, I went home to Bridgeport, Connecticut to see my immediate family. The girl I was dating at the time had invited me to a birthday party in New Haven. I gassed up the car, picked her up, and hit the road. When we arrived, we hung out for about an hour before someone said they needed to go to the liquor store. Everyone that knew me understood that I didn't drink, so I was always labeled the designated driver. I offered to take two friends that I met at the party to the liquor store. They told their friends and family, and we took off. Leaving the liquor store, I noticed a cop driving behind us. Normally, if you aren't doing anything wrong and have nothing to worry about, you shouldn't feel any type of way while being tailed by the cops. Unfortunately, that was not the case. I had many friends and family who had not had great experiences with the police, so I always get a bad feeling when they're behind me. Within minutes, the red and blue lights went off, so I pulled over. Once pulled over on the side of the road, I waited for the cop to follow through with the procedures for a routine traffic stop. That, however, did not happen. We waited in the car for about 5 minutes. I had met these two friends at the party for the first time, so I asked them both if there was any reason for that the cops would pull us over. I also asked them if there was anything I should know about before the cop walked over to the car. They both reassured me I had nothing to worry about. This traffic stop was different. A voice came over the loudspeaker telling everyone to put their hands outside the car except for the driver. Everyone followed through. The passenger in the front seat put his hands out of the window, and so did the person sitting behind. This means that all the windows were down and you could see everything in the car. On the loudspeaker, the officer told me to take the keys out of the ignition, throw them to the ground, and place my hands on the steering wheel. You could tell the officer was agitated by his voice. It did not help that everyone in my car was also nervous. I already had my license, insurance, and registration on my lap for easy access. Once the keys were on the ground, all I can see is the brightest flashlight in the world running over to me in my rearview mirror and nothing else. I'm looking straight ahead when the officer arrives at my driver's side window. As I turn to my left to greet the officer, his gun is underneath the flashlight, pointed at my face. He was a white cop, about my height, standing about 1 to 2 feet away from me, very upset. He also looked nervous. I froze and made eye contact with him while my hands were still on the steering wheel. My skin felt like pins and needles. Seconds later, I asked him what I had done wrong. Before I was able to finish my sentence, he tells me to shut up and asks me what I'm doing there. I tried to answer him, but every time I spoke, he would cut me off and tell me to shut up. I'm pretty sure I realized that at some point that this is what all the talks I'd had with my parents were for. Every other word out of his mouth was an F-bomb followed by shut up. Again, he asks me what I'm doing there, and before I can finish, cuts me off. Meanwhile, people are driving by, looking at me like a zoo animal in a cage, while the other two passengers are now nervous as well. The cop goes around to question the other passengers in the car using profane language and not once lowering his gun. It's very hard to concentrate when a loaded gun is pointed in your face against your will. You literally have no control. By the time he gets to the passenger to the back of the car, he asks him why he's crying. The passenger behind the front seat says he has a 3-year-old daughter and he has been shot before. He asks the officer to lower his gun to make us feel more comfortable and tells him that we have nothing to hide. The gun was never lowered. The officer comes back to my side and asks me what I have in the car. I let him know that we have nothing and that we're all just college kids from surrounding areas. He follows up with a similar response to the ones that came before, telling me to shut up and that he's going to search the car if he wanted to. He said that he knew we were out to cause trouble and that he needed to do what he said. Very scared, I tell him that we were only a couple minutes from where we were going and haven't done anything wrong. A white lady cop gets out of the passenger side of the cop car and comes over to him. She grabs his arm, tries to calm him down, and drags the other officer a couple steps in her direction. While he walks to his car, she's standing by my window. All my confidence and reasoning is suddenly back because the gun is lowered. Highly upset, I yell that I want his badge number, along with his name, to file the biggest complaint I could. I let her know that he never even took the time to look at my license or run any of my information. Again, I let her know that I was very calm and that I took directions very carefully. I let her know that we were not a threat. I also said that I felt that I was discriminated against. She came very close to the car window and told me to get the F out of there. Even though she was yelling, she said it in a way that indicated she was doing me some kind of favor. We left and continued our silent drive all the way back to the party. I didn't even go inside. I went straight home pissed off. I explained to my parents what had transpired. They demanded information from me about the cop and everything that had happened so that they could follow up. But really, they were just happy I was alive.
I'm moved by the stories that everyone just shared. Thank you all for your courage in telling them. Racism is not only expressed in specific overt words and deeds. It's also embedded into broader systems of belief and institutions in which we all operate. In this next segment, we'll explore the difficult question of how we got here through four vignettes, short stories on law, education, housing, and criminal justice that illustrate how racism can be entrenched, structural, sometimes imperceptible, but just as invidious. We hope that by sharing these, today becomes a new beginning for all of us to continue learning and to call ourselves to action. Before jumping in, Mark will first share a snapshot of some of the racial disparities that exist in our world today. Mark, you have the floor.
Thank you, and I want to thank all of our colleagues who shared those stories. We're here because of the tragic killing of George Floyd, and hopefully his legacy will be an awakening among us that the deaths like his are not isolated incidents, as Andrew said, but a reflection of the system not working and the ways in which systemic racism creates daily assaults and disparities in opportunity. How does the system work? While incredibly complex, when you step back and look across different organs of our society, legal, economic, environmental, the democratic process, it's not hard to see the many disparities that create negative feedback loops. Look at the stats. The average wealth of a Black member of our society is 1/10 that of a white person. In dollars, that's less than $20,000 versus $160,000. That relates to income and employment. You can't create wealth on $12 an hour. The median income of a Black household is $17,000 per year. George Floyd was one of those who lost his job in the pandemic, and unemployment is twice that of the white community going into this crisis. 2/3 of those imprisoned in America are people of color, 34% are Black. George Floyd had been imprisoned. The systems we have to change society also don't work for many people in the Black community. 1/3 of Black men cannot vote in Alabama as one example, and as Kate will speak to, many who are imprisoned lose their right to vote. The resourcing of institutions like the NAACP to protect members of the Black community and our entire society is another example. The annual budget is $30 million. Compare that to the budget of one of our departments, for example. We won't go through all of these, but in the following sections, Kate will walk through some of these systems of disparity and how they're interlinked. I'll turn it over now to Andrew, who will speak to systemic racism in our legal foundations.
Thanks, Mark. Law defines identity, instills values, and allocates power. While it can create positive change, it can also validate and entrench systemic wrongs. We can't begin to understand today's systems of injustice without first going back in time to study the forces, the choices, and the circumstances that brought us here. In this first vignette, I'll share a very brief history of constitutional law about race, from initial construction in 1787 through the modern civil rights era. Though it will barely scratch the surface, it's meant as a new beginning to our continuing education. Next slide, please. let's rewind the clock to 1787. Slavery, our country's original sin, as Madison called it, was built into our constitutional framework in language that never expressly mentions the term slavery. The Constitution created a form of race-based property. In this system, whiteness entitled its holder to full personhood, property ownership, and protection from subjugation. By taking an approach of silence, omission, and denial, our Constitution sanctioned and legitimized a legal fiction of white supremacy, a practice that sometimes persists in law today. Next slide, please. The Constitution further reinforced slavery through a system of federalism, which gave slaveholding states broad authority over slavery without interference from, and often with military support from, the federal government. Next slide. Before the war, slavery was a matter for local control, but after the Civil War, Black protection was a matter of local discretion. The passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments outlawed slavery, affirmed due process and equal protection of the laws, and provided the right to vote to Black men. But without slavery, state legislators and judges responded with a new pattern. States passed laws to stop Black people from exercising these new rights. When Black litigants challenged them in federal court with the right to exercise that, judges interpreted federal law narrowly, curtailing the scope of the protections. What ensued was a de facto system of economic subjugation and political disenfranchisement that resembled slavery through the Black codes, the Jim Crow laws, and voting restrictions, all of which continue in force or effect through the 20th century. Next slide, please. In the modern civil rights era, federal courts and legislators began to intervene against racial violence and discrimination, but did so slowly. Spurred by New Deal reforms, the Supreme Court under new leadership began to take an expansionist view of the federal government's role, as well as an activist view of constitutional rights. Through the due process clause of the 14th Amendment, the Supreme Court made certain fundamental rights binding upon the states, beginning in areas of civic life and continuing to criminal procedure. In this way, the Black struggle for freedom had a catalyzing effect upon the development of constitutional rights and liberties applicable to all citizens, regardless of color, all of us today. Next slide, please. The law and its interpretation has followed a tense and non-linear pattern of expansion and curtailments spanning across areas of civic life. In the court's precedent, I want to call attention to four trends. First, under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, the court developed a new doctrine of judicial review whereby it would apply strict scrutiny for legal classifications based upon suspect class like race. Where there is such a classification, the court will now ask whether the state action is narrowly tailored to a compelling and actual governmental purpose. Whether that is true, though, remains a subjective matter of human judgment. Second, while the 14th Amendment itself does not apply to private conduct, Congress has prohibited some forms of private discrimination under the authority provided by other sections of the Constitution, including the Interstate Commerce Clause, the Spending Power, and the 13th Amendment. Third, as case law and federal legislation dismantled Jim Crow, what has been left in the place is a legal regime largely designed to redress specific, provable bad acts. Courts have struggled to address broader and more subtle forms of discrimination. Sometimes they set those aside explicitly as beyond the reach of the law. Despite, or maybe because, the government has outlawed some forms of overt racism, what remains are laws and deeds that mask race without dislodging it. Racial discrimination has been buried deeper, but as case law today shows, it remains just as sinister. Finally, in recent decades, white plaintiffs have brought cases alleging unfairness of laws intended to rectify systemic racial wrongs. Cast in the language of White Lives Matter, some of this litigation has set boundaries, restraining 20th century doctrines responsible for expanding Black civil rights, boundaries that the court continues to face and wrestle with today. Next slide, please. I'll leave you with a few parting thoughts. The Constitution was never colorblind, and our laws today are not post-racial. Beginning with our framers, it's become an American tradition to put national unity ahead of human dignity. Under our laws today, there continue to be two Americas. Second, while law can sanitize and normalize systemic wrongs, it can also create significant positive change. Throughout our history, it's been necessary for those who suffer from exclusion and denial, as well as their allies, to put forth their case to society and to propose appropriate solutions. Third, struggle by Black litigants and their allies has been the key driver of injecting principles of liberty, equality, and freedom into the Constitution structure from which we all benefit. And last, as Wes Moore shared last week, the arc of history is long, but it only bends towards justice with human action. Progress is uneven. We move forward, backward, forward, then backward, and then forward again. But history shows us that growth comes through struggle, and it's in our most difficult moments, when we finally reach the precipice, that we may find the will to change. The law is now our unfinished business.
Everyone knows the case of Brown versus Board of Education, which ruled more than 60 years ago that segregation in public schools was inherently unequal. But today, our schools are still deeply segregated and deeply unequal. As of 2016, Black students, on average, attended schools where 47% of the student body was also Black. By comparison, only 15% of public school students in total are Black. So why is this still a problem? Why are schools still so segregated? After the Brown v. Board decision, there was tremendous backlash to desegregating schools. Many of you are probably familiar with the case of the Little Rock Nine, where nine Black high school students ultimately needed military protection from angry mobs to attend an all-white high school. Other cases garnered a lot less media attention. Many school districts quietly implemented their own plans to delay or deny implementation of desegregation, including closing certain schools. Even beyond these overt efforts to prevent desegregation, one of the most significant barriers to desegregation involved the neighborhoods where children lived. In 1971, the Supreme Court ruled that busing programs could be used to speed up racial integration of public schools. The federal government also enacted other programs to promote desegregation. For example, Nixon conditioned federal aid to compliance with desegregation court orders. There's compelling evidence that a mix of concrete efforts from the federal government did help reduce segregation in schools for a time. The chart on this next slide shows one measure. Over the 70s and 80s, the percentage of Black students in predominantly minority schools decreased in most regions. But starting in the 1990s, the Supreme Court began walking back the ability for the federal government to enforce desegregation. Next slide, please. There are several relevant court cases here, but to give one example of a recent case, in 2007, the Supreme Court rejected voluntary desegregation plans, finding it unconstitutional for school districts to rely on the race of individual students when making school assignment decisions for students. Next slide. Why does school segregation matter? It's because separate but equal is a fallacy. U.S. schools are unequal in their funding, which disproportionately disadvantages African American kids. On average, non-white districts received about $2,200 less per student than districts that were predominantly white, based on data from the 2015 to 2016 school year. This type of funding discrepancy is present in 21 states and is worse in some places than others. Next slide. Funding matters. On average, aggregate measures of per pupil spending are positively associated with improved or higher student outcomes. The size of this effect is larger in some studies, but the overwhelming evidence clearly shows that funding matters. Next slide. So having equal educational resources is a really powerful tool to decreasing racial disparities. I can't go into all of the studies here because there are too many, but to give one example, in a comparative study of 300 Chicago first graders, researchers found that African American and white students who had comparable instruction achieved comparable levels of reading skill. But they also found that the quality of instruction given African American students was on average much lower than that given white students, thus creating a racial gap in aggregate achievement at the end of first grade. Next slide. I'll end with this. Early disparities in educational opportunity lead to really long-lasting consequences. The 6-year graduation rate for first-time full-time undergraduate students who began their pursuit of a bachelor's degree at 4-year institutions was highest for Asian students at 74%, followed by white students at 64%. For Black students, the 6-year graduation rate is just 40%. Compared with white students, Black graduates are far more likely to attend a for-profit college, and they are less likely to attend 4-year or nonprofit institutions. Black graduates also generally attend institutions that have less money to spend on offering a quality education and are significantly underrepresented in higher paying quantitative fields such as engineering, math, stats, and physical sciences. These educational disparities then have long-lasting implications for employment and racial inequality. With that, I'm going to pass the ball to Will, who is going to pick up the story from here.
Disparate access to education is just one way among many that, on average, Black people in this country face substantially different economic opportunities and outcomes relative to their white peers. As Mark mentioned earlier, unemployment is about twice as high for Black Americans as for white Americans. And on average, they receive wages that are around 20 to 30% lower, as shown on the chart on the right. As that chart highlights, those differences in large part persist even after we control for the differences in educational opportunity highlighted. Many Black people also face implicit bias and explicit discrimination from employers, as well as other obstacles from geography to less tangible barriers that place people on an uneven starting line. Next slide, please. These differences in income accumulate over time, and given that wealth taxes and redistribution are very limited and America's history of racism is long and severe, the economic gap is even more stark when we look at wealth. The fact that the wealth of the median white family in the US is 10 times that of the median Black family is central to the vicious cycle in access to education, housing, employment, and healthcare. Next slide, please. It's important to remember that those disparities didn't just arise because of the accumulated denial of opportunities, but also because at times white people deliberately destroyed the wealth that Black citizens had accumulated in spite of those barriers. Some of these cases were the vindictive acts of violent mobs. Most prominently, as shown in the top two images here, in 1921, white people massacred Black residents in Greenwood, Tulsa, the neighborhood known as Black Wall Street for its relative affluence, and effectively burned the community to the ground. However, we also shouldn't understate the more subtle and insidious role of many respectable elements of white society in propagating wealth destruction. For example, in Tulsa, the city deliberately made it substantially more difficult through zoning to rebuild Greenwood in the hope of acquiring that land cheaply for other purposes. And more generally, city works had a tendency toward destroying Black wealth for the benefit of others. Major roads would often be discriminatively routed through poorer Black neighborhoods to spare adjacent white property, and urban renewal projects disproportionately involved removing Black residents without fair compensation to build new housing developments. Next slide, please. One of the most significant aspects of these wealth inequalities is housing, especially given the role that real estate plays in many households' wealth, as well as the impact of geography on access to opportunities. Andrew already touched on the role of outright legal segregation, which had mandated divisions between white and Black communities. But the reality is that forms of de facto segregation arose even without those and persist into today, which is what these maps from the Washington Post highlight. On the left, we have DC and on the right, Chicago. And what you can see is these stark dividing lines between communities inhabited by white people and those inhabited by Black people. What you can't see on the map is the extent to which those neighborhoods are substantially unequal in terms of people's living conditions, economic well-being, access to government services, policing, and environmental quality. Thinking about how those separations arose and how they've been maintained, the economic inequalities that we already spoke about obviously play a really significant role in the self-sustaining way that is characteristic of systemic institutional racism. But I wanted to finish by highlighting some of the more direct acts and policies of racist discrimination that produce these patterns by design. Next slide, please. The concept of redlining originated with the Homeowners Loan Corporation, which was part of an important federal mortgage program launched in the 30s. As part of that program, the government assessed the perceived risks of lending to each neighborhood. And African-American neighborhoods were largely shut out from the credit resources because they were very disproportionately identified as so-called hazardous areas, which were shaded as red on the maps. This wasn't just a product of the existing wealth disparities being carried forward. Instead, the assessments were often explicitly racist, with just a few examples from our area shown on this page. Next slide, please. This redlining in federal programs was accompanied by widespread discrimination by state and local governments, housing developers, banks, and other residents. That had been made illegal in 1866, but wasn't enforced federally until the 1968 Fair Housing Act, signed days after the assassination of Martin Luther King. The Fair Housing Act was a material step forward achieved through the civil rights movement, but widespread evidence of discrimination continued through the 70s to this day. In short, Black people were and are today several times more likely to be denied a mortgage as white people with comparable credit history, while banks also take account of the existing wealth disparities in a way which is bound to perpetuate them. In addition, many Black people have faced, and face today, obstacles and barriers imposed by landlords or realtors to prevent them from moving into specific neighborhoods or properties. Each of these individual decisions helps to add up to the system of separation and inequality that I started by describing. And with that, I'm handing over to Kate to talk more about criminal justice.
The legacy of the housing and educational discrimination that Will just discussed is being felt in the criminal justice system today and in the unequal outcomes that face Black people and white people when they enter the criminal justice system and in their likelihood to enter the system in the first place. As you'll see on the next slide, the racial disparities in the US prison population are vast. As Mark mentioned earlier, the US makes up less than 5% of the world's population. They make up a quarter of the world's prison population. Within that, the majority of prisoners are people of color, and within that, the majority of people are Black. Black people are much more likely to end up in prison than their white counterparts. They're much more likely to be facing tougher sentences, often for the exact same crime. And those sentencing disparities are most severe when it comes to misdemeanors, which are the least severe forms of crime where you see the discretion working out against the favor of Black people. So how do you get somewhere where this thing is true? As Will said, the US has a history of trapping Black people in poor neighborhoods and denying them the ability to accumulate wealth. Those poor neighborhoods are in turn over-policed, and crimes there are over-reported relative to other neighborhoods. In addition to that, many of those redline communities that Will talked about, as they become gentrified, you watch the police presence in those places only increase, which makes the problem worse. Decades of policy in the US has geared towards appearing tough on crime, and that toughness on crime has also disproportionately affected Black people. What started in the years after the Civil Rights Act as Nixon's like rhetorical tough on crime stance gets picked up by Reagan as a literal war on drugs. And within the policies in the war on drugs, you have explicit differences in the way that racialized crimes are treated. One very concrete example is the difference in the sentencing for crack and cocaine. What you saw in the mandatory sentences there are that 5 grams of crack carried the same sentence as 500 grams of cocaine. The difference between those two drugs is pretty minimal. They're the same thing, but they're taken differently, and they're also taken differently by white people versus Black people. Also, in addition to that, 50 grams of possession of cocaine carried absolutely no minimum sentence whatsoever. The effects of those policies were then amplified in the following years by the 1994 crime bill, which introduced two further policies. The first thing is the introduction of truth in sentencing, which aims to get rid of parole. So it keeps Black people, if we move back to the first slide, it keeps Black people out of their communities for longer as they face the full force of their sentences. And the second thing, the more insidious one, is the three strikes policy, which ramps up the penalties for misdemeanors and enforces harsher penalties for multiple offenses. Three strikes, coupled with the increasing popularity of a policy called broken windows policing, comes together to disproportionately incriminate young Black people in those over-policed and poor neighborhoods that Will was talking about. Broken windows policing is the theory that if you criminalize smaller events early on, and so you catch people doing things like jaywalking, littering, doing graffiti, you will in time reduce the higher and more severe crimes. But when you couple that attitude with a three strikes law, what you see is disproportionately more severe punishments for people who are conducting misdemeanors and who are on the whole not producing huge amounts of threat. Then the last legal policy, which is a more recent one that adds to the problem, is the legalization of stop and frisk policies, which hands police officers the discretion to stop people based on visual cues or interpretations of their suspiciousness. When you introduce a policy like that, unsurprisingly, what you see is racial bias in the people who get pulled over, as you couple that discretion with decades of narratives about Black criminality. On the next couple of slides, we walk through what those things look like. So on the next page, you can see the difference in the drug-related arrests by race. And you can see how in the years following the war on drugs, the number of arrests for Black people grew massively, and it remains elevated through today, despite efforts to try and unwind some of those laws. The sentencing differences are also massive, not just in the case where there's like explicit, where there was explicit mandate for it back in the late 60s, but even through today. On the next slide, you can see the racial bias in stop and frisk policies. The orange shows the number of people who have been stopped who are Black, while the white shows you, while the green shows you the number of people who are white. As you can see, there's an overwhelming racial bias in these stoppings. And then you can also see that the number of these instances that involve force or that become escalated are much higher. Part of that is just the fact that you have increased interactions between the police and these people. And another part of that is that you increase the tension and stress that people are feeling in those interactions, which means there's an increased likelihood that things turn more violent. Once people are then arrested or taken into custody, the next slide shows you some of the differences in the way sentencing is carried out. The first thing on the left shows you the racial disparities in the people who are granted bail. And there's a couple things here that are particularly difficult. The first thing is that money for bail allows people who can afford to get out of prison to await their trials from outside jail, while people who cannot afford it are not able to do the same thing. This is particularly insidious when you consider the things that Will was saying about the huge wealth disparities and cash disparities between Black and white people. Beyond that, the type of plea offers that people are given also vary massively in their nature. And you see a disproportionate number of Black defendants being given plea deals that include jail time. And so they spend more time behind bars. And then the last two charts show you some of the massive differences in sentencing and also show how severe those differences are relative to the severity of the crime. All of this comes together to add up to a picture of disenfranchisement, which is on the next slide, because in the US, prisoners lose their ability to vote for the time that they're in jail, and in many states, for the time afterwards, and have to meet criteria to be given it back. You can see this disparity on the next slide in a map of the US, which shows which percentage of people have been disenfranchised by state. And with that, I'll hand over to Will.
Kate highlighted the Kate highlighted the disenfranchisement of convicted people and its impact on the representation of Black communities. This isn't an isolated phenomenon. In law, the 15th Amendment guaranteed Black Americans the right to vote in 1870, but in practice, that right has been substantially impeded. Through a sustained and effective process of activism, Black voters have gradually more fully realized their right to vote, first by challenging the especially egregious poll taxes, educational requirements, and grandfather clauses, and later in securing the landmark Voting Rights Act of 1965. But even now, felony disenfranchisement is by no means the only policy which has either the intention or the disproportionate effect of substantially disenfranchising African-American people. Three buckets stood out to me when researching this. First, policies which impose targeted bureaucratic requirements, such as requiring specific forms of voter ID, complicated registration processes, and purges of voter rolls. Second, policies which make the act of voting itself more difficult, through a lack of poll stations in minority neighborhoods or constraints on absentee ballots. And finally, policies which unfairly skew legislative districts. Racial gerrymandering is unconstitutional, but difficult to actually see enforced. And the Census Bureau's policy for disenfranchised prisoners to be credited to the places in which they are imprisoned rather than their home communities allocates their representation to those communities with which they have very little connection. In short, this has accelerated since the Supreme Court recently gutted key components of the Voting Rights Act, and is particularly relevant in the context of the ongoing pandemic, which has disproportionately hit Black people and further complicates in-person democratic participation. In other words, while protest, legal efforts, and activism have brought us much closer to realizing the promise of our democracy, there is still a long way to go. And with that, I'm handing over to Mark to talk more about protest.
We want to conclude with a point around the power of protest. And this page has two images. It has a reenactment on the top of a lone woman protesting in South Africa's townships during apartheid, and then a woman protesting today as part of the Black Lives Matter movement in America. The vehicles you see are literally the same. It is a military vehicle the South Africa apartheid government created and used to create terror and strike down protests in the 1980s. That vehicle, known as the Caspier, was eventually sold to the US military and eventually leased by the US military to local police forces and is now showing up in American cities in Black Lives Matter protests. I don't want to stretch the analog too far, and I don't mean to undermine the men and women who serve to protect us, which I'm grateful for. But it is a tragic irony that apartheid was modeled on Jim Crow, and that the vehicle used to enforce apartheid now in South Africa now creates terror in Black communities in America. To me, these images are personally emotive as a son of white South Africans and a husband of a Black woman who learned to run from these vehicles growing up in apartheid South Africa and who is now part of the movement today. I think it is a message of the power of an individual to stand up and take action. South Africa's protesters eventually felled the apartheid government, and the new ANC government wrote perhaps one of the most humane constitutions in the world, modeled on the US Constitution and our Bill of Rights, but with an emphasis on the equality of all people. We will now turn to breakout sessions on what we can do.